Welcome back to the Fifth Estate podcast. It's our first episode for 2020, and it's been a shocking year so far, with large parts of the world now grappling with the spread of a coronavirus. In Australia, we started the year with an unprecedented bushfire crisis. Last Tuesday, the 10th of March, host Sally Warhaft spoke about the urgent issue of the fires with environmentalist and former Australian Greens leader Bob Brown.
Bob, of course, I'm sure you all know his extended biography. I'll give a very brief one. He was elected to the Senate in 1996 after a decade in Tasmania's state parliament. He became leader of the Australian Greens in 2005 until he stepped down in 2012 and formed the Bob Brown Foundation, dedicated to supporting campaigns for the environment in Australia and the region. He's the author of numerous books, and the North Melbourne bookshop will be selling them after the event, and Bob will autograph them for you, including his memoir and volumes of poetry and photography. And he's recently been hanging out with Margaret Atwood in the Tarkine Forest, which I thought... Anyway, welcome, Bob Brown.
Thanks, Sally. Thanks, everybody. Lovely to be here.
We're here to, you know, talk about the Australian summer, but I think in some respects it's spilling into to other events in some ways as well. So we'll see where we land tonight.
Sure.
In our conversation, Bob. But welcome. And to start, can you just tell us about your summer?
Well, I've had a great summer. I've spent a lot of it with Paul, who's here tonight, my partner on the farm, pulling out weeds. And that it overlooks the mouth of the Huon River and the D'Entrecasteaux Channel. And the French, second French fleet in the region of Breton in 1801 pitched up on the beach right next to our house, and there was a 16-year-old called Ura Ura. And she captured the French mariners' hearts, and they gave her a red feather, which they picked up in Western Australia. A young fellow called Breton picked up on and he had it in his hat. They'd given him mirrors and beads and things, and she wasn't interested, but she grabbed this feather, jumped in the air, did a pirouette, tore into the bush, and they thought they'd committed some great travesty against her culture. But she brought back her father and brothers and was, in Breton's word, altogether transported with ecstasy at this feather, because Ura Ura means Ura Ura, yellow-tailed black cockatoo. We don't have the red ones in Tasmania, but he'd presented her with a red-tailed black cockatoo, and she was just delighted by this gift from these very ruly and proper French mariners of 1801.
That is a beautiful story, and I want a feather now. So you were tucked away in a safe spot as the fires ravaged so much.
Well,
of the Australian
in times. A way, yes. But just last year, January, 12 months ago, the fires burnt out 250,000 hectares of the Western Tasmanian wilderness. And while only a much smaller number than in the recent mainland fires of structures was burnt, these fires had Cygnet wrapped in smoke for weeks, a bit like Sydney and also Melbourne. In fact, one night the news came on as Paul was washing up and I was wiping up, and said that the air pollution in Cygnet, our nearby town, was worse, 13 times worse than New Delhi. And the advice from the medical advisers in the Tasmanian government was that people under 5 or over 70 should leave. So I put down the tea towel and said to Paul, "See, I'm going." He made me finish the wiping up.
I think, didn't you promise more domestic duties since you left Parliament?
Well, Paul said he hoped When I left Parliament, he got asked what I should do, and he said he hoped I'd do a bit more around the house, more domestic duties. And I got 12 tea towels and an apron in the mail. I do my best.
Good. We all do. Do you think Australians... We all know Australia is fire prone, and that fires are a part of this continent. But do you think that Australians generally really understand that? What does it mean?
No, I don't. Most of us live in the metropolises, 70% do, and bushfires, they affect friends, relatives. We, 70% plus Australians knew somebody and felt directly affected by the fires this summer. But it's still a distant, comparatively distant reality, and in the centre of the big cities we feel relatively safe, even if inconvenienced by smoke and the idea that other people are not far away, places we go to and love, are being burnt, and indeed wildlife with it. But it's as if it's a war being fought not too far away, but it's not going to come and get us. And so I think Australians are worried about it, but have no concept of trying to prevent it. I'm talking about the generality here, of pitching in to prevent it getting worse. And just today, we've had a former top UN official saying it's going to get 6 or 8 times worse in the coming years in Australia. And we know that what's now become disastrous in terms of bushfires will by 2040, on current projections of ordinary behaviour, if we don't change anything, will be normal. And this last summer, by 2060, will be a cool summer as we head into this heating future, which is coming about because of our own inaction and dereliction. And it's a question which... really, I think, Sally, is a test between our intelligence and our instinct, our intelligent ability to override our need to feel comfortable and to get more goods. Those two things are on a collision course, and at the moment, feeling comfortable and getting more goods in this age of materialism, where I don't think there's a government on the planet that doesn't subscribe to the central economic pillar of growth. Just incompatible with what was 2.5 billion people when I came onto the planet in 1944 and is now 8 billion. And the trajectory continues up until into next century. Here we are in the wealthiest country on the planet, the wealthiest large country in terms of income and resources, but all I hear about is complaining. And not, okay, let's be a big Switzerland or a big Norway and let's start tackling the problems of the world by taking a lead. We're at the back of the class, unfortunately.
We really are. And there seems to be a particularly Australian tension around all of this. I mean, we hear poll after poll, survey after survey, the vast majority of Australians obviously, they believe in climate science, they believe that climate change exists, and yet continually vote in governments.
A simple statistic there, Sally, at the election in May just gone last year, at a poll taken in that month, 90% of Australians wanted either a lot more or at least some more government spending to tackle climate change. And on May the 19th, 90% of Australians voted for more coal mines, parties representing more coal mines. So there is a disjuncture, and it's because it yet hasn't quite gripped us what we're doing. But that's a normal history. You know, it's a normal course of events. Nero said in 2,000 years ago, give them bread and circuses. And as long as we're entertained or given reassurance, and the Murdoch media dishes that up in spades, we'll get on and say it's not our responsibility, it's somebody else's fault. But in a democracy where we do have a valid... People say to me, Bob, why weren't you minister for this or prime minister or something like that? And I said, because 90% of Australians voted against us. 87% anyway. And I don't blame people for that. You pick up a Rupert Murdoch paper saying, for God's sake, whatever, this is the old man himself, don't let the Greens near the economy. Terror, horror, shock. And yet he's the wrecker. He's the planet wrecker extraordinaire. And so many other media organisations ride on those coattails of climate denialism, and growth is good. The god of growth, capital G, is it the new global religion, and we dare not question it. Otherwise, there'll be unemployment, recession, pestilence, and so on. We're getting those things quite well, even in an age of growth. And yet, we don't subscribe to the rational limits of this beautiful, finite little planet of ours, which, so far as we know, is the only place where life, love and laughter in the form of intelligence, such as our human intelligence, exists. And we're treating it as if it's expendable and as if... you know, one of the remarkable things that I hear from time to time is people who have grandchildren saying, oh, well, I don't care because I'm not going to be here. I find that an extraordinary, really, punishment of self, a failure to feel good about oneself and to feel kindness and compassion. But maybe it's there in the mix, and it's just something that we... Can I tell you a very short story?
You can tell it as long as you like, Bob. It's your floor.
In 1987... It's in that book, Optimism, up there. I brought into the Tasmanian Parliament, at the behest of legal and social thinkers, a bill to ban semi-automatic rifles. And I was laughed down. And if you look at the Hansard of that second reading speech, it's Dr. Brown interrupted, interjections, Dr. Brown stopped, so on. So it went. It was such an outrageous thing to do. In the Port Arthur tragedy, which followed 7 years later, Christine Milne gave that bill to the government, gave it to John Howard, and it became national law within a month or so. And it appears that we're post-catastrophic creatures. We can't use our God-given intelligence or our created evolved intelligence to... look at the future and shape it accordingly. We have to go through, and human history is full of this, we have to go through the full catastrophic consequences of denying our own intelligence before we wake up and react to it. Now, I'm an optimist because I believe we can change that around. But by crikey, we're going to have to be more active. Those of us who can see, who... spend our days thinking about this failure of humanity to look after itself on this planet, let alone our fellow creatures. And that's why I'm up in the Tarkine rainforest, and I'll be there again this weekend with folk from our foundation sitting in the trees, obstructing the chainsaws, knocking down those forests, which are full of carbon, full of rare and endangered species, and full, above all, of the curative, inspiring, delightful, you know, mind-healing forest qualities which are now rapidly disappearing off an ever more populated planet. It is such a phenomenal resource for the future, but currently taxpayers are actually paying through state and federal governments to have those forests logged down and exported as wood chips to Japan and China. Not very sensible.
Is your optimism like a sort of, you know, test tube that's always sort of full and bubbling, and it just stays at this lovely even sort of level? Or do you find that it dips and you need to fill it, fill your bucket?
I think you were walking around the paddock with me when I was picking mushrooms yesterday and using four-letter words that Presbyterians should never use about the failure of humanity to be sensible.
Yeah.
No, I confront that. But I did spend quite a while as a youngster depressed, clinically depressed, because of the, you know, the exigency of the world in the 1960s, and worked out it wasn't a good place to be. And you know, it's an empirical choice. But what we do know is that pessimism knocks you out and optimism counts you in. And it's a very potent right we have. And, you know, I never tire of quoting Bertrand Russell, British philosopher of 70 years ago, saying, "The trouble with the world is that the stupid are cocksure." Now, he wasn't here referring to Australian or American politicians, because this is 70 years ago. The trouble with the world is the stupid are cocksure and the intelligent are full of self-doubt. And so the intelligent automatically tend to say, oh, I'm not sure if I'm right or wrong. They're saying that very definitively. They know. Well, we all have a responsibility to respond to our own intelligence and convert it into action. That is, as our foundation's motto is, don't get depressed, get active. And for many people, that's a step too far, going from knowing about the problem to becoming active. So I just live for the day when this planet will see millions of people peacefully on the streets and outside parliaments demanding change. And until we get that, we're in that handbasket on our way to a hot place. And we shouldn't be. You know, we shouldn't be. And I just love being part of the idea that we can save ourselves from ourselves. You know, I just had to mention the word Trump to Margaret Atwood to understand that there are more intelligent people than me thinking exactly the same way.
It's obviously just a very strange time at the moment, and for Australia at the end of the fires, and now, of course, this coronavirus. There were really amped up remarks today from the Victorian Premier about expectations in the coming weeks. And I don't know if it's just me. I suspect it's not. I feel an anxiety, a very broad, weird kind of feeling. I can't think of anything like it in my lifetime that has presented a sort of a force up against all the systems that politics around the world has depended on in my lifetime, that no system, no political system can actually stop. And I wonder, Bob, what you make of this virus and the human response to that, because it's certainly been quicker and perhaps more cooperative than the response to the threats of climate change. How have you observed it?
Well, we haven't responded in any meaningful way at all to the threat of climate change. And this country and current trajectories for climate change, and the Bureau of Meteorology echoed this just last week, have us on trajectory to a 4 degrees hotter planet by the end of the century. And that's catastrophic. Some scientists are saying that that will allow a population of humans, and we're the biggest herd of mammals ever to graze the planet, of about 500 million. And you look at the other 80% of humanity that's not going to be there, if that were to be the case. This will be argued, of course, until the end of, until those cows are there coming home at the end of the century. But we are in catastrophic circumstances, and what's happening with coronavirus is that it's also predictable, because as bigger populations, epidemiologists would be very quick to point this out, as you get bigger populations of any animal, it's much more likely to see the spread of disease and rapidly through that population. And that's what we're seeing with the coronavirus. My mum and dad were in their teen years when the so-called Spanish flu, which as best we know started somewhere near Austin, Texas in the United States at army camps at the end of World War One, and both in Sydney and at Glen Innes, a little town on the northern tablelands of New South Wales, the trucks came round to take the bodies away as 40 million people around the planet died from that epidemic in 1921. And Australians had no antibiotics. We had no way really of dealing with that. And it got young people. The coronavirus is much more leaving young people alone and is clobbering people of my age. In the older you get, the more likely you are to have a fatal outcome from catching this virus. And that's one good thing about it compared to that terrible flu back in the 100 years ago. But there's been, I remember the so-called Hong Kong flu of 1969. I was in Darwin as a young doctor. I caught it. I have never been so ill in my life. I was young then. Older people didn't get it because, as with that flu in 1920, there'd been a flu through 20 or 30 years earlier, which was one much milder, but which was close enough to help inoculate older people against it. With this coronavirus, that hasn't happened. And because it's causing pneumonia in weaker systems, older people are tending to fare worse with it. But we can expect more of it. And Paul and I had dinner with Dick and Pip Smith in Hobart just night before last. And he's, of course, you might say, got a bee in his bonnet about a population. But, of course, he's quite right. There are too many of us. And this is getting very hard to manage because, amongst other things, we're using 170% of the living resources of this one planet now. That's why every morning we wake up to less forest, less species, less arable land, less fisheries, and more mouths to feed than the day before. And 80 million people a year more on the planet per annum at the moment. And yet in 2013, when Tony Abbott was Prime Minister, coming in to reverse the one set of legislation which has turned around climate change, that is carbon greenhouse gas emissions, in its tracks, the one that I signed off with Christine Milne and Julia Gillard, he reversed that. That, by the way, led to, over the 2 years it was in place, the only reduction in greenhouse gases in modern Australian history. It went down by 2% while the economy went up by 5%. But he came in the last week of the election, promised Australians that he would take $4 billion out of overseas aid and put it into fixing up roads here in Australia. And we loved it. Up went his vote. I remember Tim Costello at the time, from this great city, saying, but please, this is going to lead to hundreds of thousands of more infant deaths overseas. What it also led to, of course, was a much smaller budget for helping to educate people who are illiterate elsewhere in the world. And we know that with literacy comes prosperity, and with both of those things comes a fall off in reproductive excesses. You know, family sizes come right back into size. In other words, it's the biggest, best way that we can help reduce future population increases. But Australians loved the idea of that money going into roads instead, and so we have got better roads.
With the benefit now of literally 2020 hindsight, if you went back to the beginning of your parliamentary career with the goals that you wanted to achieve, are there things you would have done differently?
No, I was too shy and reticent, and you get more determined. But I have people frequently say, "Bob, why didn't you say that while you were in the Senate?" Well, I did, but the eyes would roll up on the government and Labor benches and they'd walk out and the press gallery would go. And so you could talk about, and I did talk about climate change right back there in the 90s, and the fact that then sea level rises would be up to 1 metre. We're now predicting 3 metres to 4 metres on just current ordinary trajectory. But I said 1 metre and the Senate broke out laughing. And Senator Wood, lovely Liberal doctor, GP from Sydney, came over and said, "Oh, Bob, forgive us for laughing. You said sea level rises were going to be 1 metre and, of course, you meant 1 centimetre." And I said, "No, I didn't. I meant 1 metre. And he stopped laughing, and after that, the Senate stopped laughing a bit down the line too. But every time I would talk about at the Senate doors, Sally, you know, or there's all the microphones, about the real challenges confronting the world, in particular climate change and species depletion and the inequality of human beings around the planet, the pencils would go down and the microphones would turn off. But they wanted to know what you thought, hopefully negatively, about some fellow human beings also doing their best in the parliamentary arena. Having said that, democracy is well, as Winston Churchill said in 1947, despite its warts and all, is the best form of governance that we have yet devised. And it's an enormous privilege to be in there. And I think we're seeing a trend towards more women, more young people, certainly more Indigenous people as well, getting into our parliaments. And that's a sleeper, because I think that prescription is earth-saving. And to see in Time magazine just 3 weeks ago, those 5 young women in Finland who rule the country, Prime Minister, Leader of the Opposition, Leader of the Greens and so on, 5 of them, 4 of them, 2 of them are 34 and 2 of them are 32, was to see the most hopeful prescription there is for the future. I jumped the fence in 1976 in Launceston to go to what was called the Penguins Club. It was a debating set up, and I was on my bicycle from the nearby surgery. I had the bike at the time because I could get to locals faster on that than I could in the car. But I jumped the fence and I was asked to give a talk, and I naively gave a talk to the 30 or 40 people there saying, "Well, men have stuffed this up. It wouldn't be bad if we had 1 century now where men just moved out of the way and women had control of the planet. We couldn't do any worse." You could hear a pin drop. No questions. What is he on about? And I went and got over the fence, and as I was getting over the fence to get back on my bike, I thought, "Oh, you made a mess of that one, Bob." but here I now see it being spoken about openly, and I think the Dalai Lama got it right when he grabbed the hand of... I was there in Adelaide 10 or 15 years ago, and a 14-year-old schoolgirl in Adelaide, Sally, asked him, "What was the most important thing that a young person could have?" And he grabbed hold of her hand and he looked her in the eye, and I thought, here comes compassion and generosity and kindness. And he said, "Self-confidence." And he was so right. Mm. It's the getting of self-confidence by otherwise kindly-hearted people. And it's difficult because less kindly people who are less thoughtful about others are more likely to be confident. It's that Bertrand Russell statement again. Well, this world is not for faint-hearted, kind people. It's for kindness and compassion and far-sightedness being worn as a badge of honour as people demand changes from our current trajectory. in the interests of the planet and our future kith and kin.
It felt at the end of the fires in Australia this summer that there was some momentum, not just here but around the world, about what had happened here, and conversations around climate change and so on. But it feels like that and a lot of other important conversations too are all going to come to a slamming halt for the momentum will be taken out of that, given other current events. And I mean, will that be restarted? What were your thoughts at the end of the bushfires, with the optimism around the idea that people would see things perhaps differently?
My dad was a policeman, and you've just reminded me, Sally, of him talking about the Second World War. He was in Sydney when there was an all-in battle between American Marines and Australian soldiers in Central Railway Station. And there was blood on the floor, you know. Here were these young men fighting each other. And that took all the headlines. They tried to repress it, but it took all the news and the headlines. But it very quickly passed. And the overall war and the need to be together for it was back in control. And that's what's going to happen. I think we haven't yet seen the half of this virus. And I have, for some weeks now, told my little office of six or eight people that we are about to close and people can work from home and take sensible precautions that we're reading about. But it will pass. There will be a death toll, but we have to remember there were 2,000 people died last year in Australia from flu, and most of those were older folk. And we will then be we're going to be year after year relentless and season after season, because when it's hot here, it's cold up there and vice versa. We're going to be relentlessly now confronted by the impact of the climate emergency and the population emergency, which is the driving factor for that, and the failure of our ability to change away from this growth economics. It will give way, but the question is, will it give way before and we get to a real thirst for a sustainable living relationship with each other and with the planet, or not? And so I don't mind too much that we are diverted, because this is a real crisis. Mm-hmm. The coronavirus crisis is real and is certainly immediately worrying. But my and many other people's eye is on the much bigger self-created calamity overtaking humanity. And it's our children now. There's children now in primary school who are going to have to live with that and try to make the best out of it. And it's going to be a much bigger hit on their lives than this virus is threatening to be on our lives. I see some estimates that 40 to 60% of the global population will catch the virus before it peters out. I don't know, you know, unless we do get a vaccine to it, it will keep going. But you know, we will deal with it. It will have a terrible, and it is having a terrible impact now, but it is a skirmish compared to the war with our own consciences and our own intelligences that is challenging every one of us in 2020.
Mm. I don't know how many people here know or recall that Bob worked as a general practitioner for 10 years before all the other things you do. Do you have a sense, with your background in medical knowledge and your experience in Parliament, about how well equipped we are to deal with the coronavirus in our political systems? Have you been?
Not very well. Well,
no,
I mean, we've
great.
Been we've been too slow. But every other country's in the same situation, and it's extraordinary. Reading the Financial Review on the way up here in the plane today, it's full of the economic impact of coronavirus, and you know, the impact in other countries. India, Italy now in lockdown, and Iran, and of course China, is taking a back seat. It won't if we get much worse figures in Australia. But I think we all have to just be personally sensible about this. I think it's good we talk about it a lot. And we are, despite the shortages that I hear the medical profession already talking about, you know, in Indigenous Today's News, there just isn't the equipment to adequately bring in the health measures necessary in Indigenous Australia. Well, we all know that spending on Indigenous health is below the average for Australians anyway. But we will equip ourselves better than almost any other country on earth. We are able to do that. But it's going to get a bit tough. And of course, the farce of the I was in the IGA in Signet the other day, and we had run out of toilet paper. I swear, and went to get a four roll lot of toilet paper, and the shelves were almost empty. And Sadie there, who owns the supermarkets, was talking to another woman. She says, looks to me and says, "Bob, I don't understand it. I don't understand the world," she says, looking at her empty shelves. And I said, "Sadie, I do." And she said, "Well, what?" I said, "It's going down the gurgle, the kitchen sink." "Oh," she said, "now I understand." But, you know, I it's a simple, again, instinctive personal fear and a protectiveness that goes to great lengths of absurdity in history. And this is where leaders are required. And we have a paucity of them at the moment. We'll see. I think out of the bright-eyed youngsters I see in this country who are speaking up about climate change and the extinction crisis and the inequalities that we have allowed to overtake our society, like the global society, there is real nidus for hope there, and they need every ounce of encouragement that can be given them. And so I think, you know, that this crisis is going to test out Australia. I see the letters in the paper saying what happened to we Australians who are also community-minded, and we respond to crises, you'd think, listening to the media better than other human beings on the planet, and of course that's not right. But we lead ourselves to believe we do, just the same as we don't throw babies into the ocean when we're on a sinking ship. And we have fed ourselves on a lot of myths, but we are human beings, like Peruvians, Nepalese and Icelanders. And we, community, will rise to the occasion, but there'll be a lot of perversities in amongst that. And we know that an ordered society, and an ordered democratic society, is the best option that there is in this circumstance. And I'm glad we have that. Whatever our leadership, it is being tested by this, and a leadership of social conscience, the global social conscience of this nation, is what's at test here. It's not whether it's Scott Morrison or Albo or Adam Bandt. It's the collective social conscience of us all that's being tested here. And I think it'll come out winning on this occasion. The far bigger test of the extrapolation of the bushfire disaster of this summer is another matter. And maybe how we respond and finally go past the virus emergency will alert us to the need to be wiser and more thoughtful about the bigger emergency, which is going to get back onto centre stage shortly after that.
You were mentioning primary school children, and I've got a couple of them. My twins turned 5 last week and they started school this year. They're little preppies, and last night they were in bed and I thought they were both asleep. It was way past the normal sleep hour. I hear the voice of my son calling out, "Mummy, Mummy, come quickly, I've got to tell you something." It's like 8:15, it was very late. And they go to bed early. and I went to Elijah's room and I said, what is it? Why aren't you asleep? And he said, "I can't sleep, Mummy, I've got to tell you something." I said, "What is it?" And he said, "When I grow up, I'm going to change the world." It was out of nowhere. You know, I'm very mindful of, you know, for an over-opinionated person, I'm very careful we don't have news on or radio. I'm really... So I was interested in where this had even come from, let alone that it might be keeping him awake at night.
Look, I think that's so important, though.
Well, I've got to tell you the second bit, because said to him, this is the cheerful bit, and I'm not the optimist on this stage. I said to him, "How are you going to change the world, darling?" And he said, "I'm going to plant flowers everywhere." I just collapsed in love, you know.
That's wonderful.
It was beautiful.
Isn't that?
It was so beautiful. But it was also afterwards, you know, this is where I'm, you know, I overthink things perhaps, later, where I was thinking, where is it that he's worrying that he needs to change the world at barely 5 years old? What is coming into his orbit that he feels he needs to change his world? And we hear a lot about young people, perhaps I didn't think that young, and the anxieties that they're carrying. And you must encounter that. What's your response to that?
Encourage them again to be self-confident. And if he's going to change the world, isn't that inspiring? I find the young Gen Z or younger people in the next generation, there is something in the air at the moment, you know, and having some of you may recollect the early 60s and flower power.
Right.
Leading to a transformation in society in many ways, not least for women. And it didn't, of course, make the world perfect, but it did make the world much better. And thank goodness. And it got rid of bigotries from my time, which you can hardly explain to people now, existed then. And there is this, maybe your son has it right, there's a new flower power in the world. And it does come out of enjoying beauty and love and compassion and wanting the world to be the great place and secure place that it can be. And so changing the world is a great concept, and being encouraging youngsters who then run into the power of the money that runs the world at the moment. You know, the power of the coal miners and the armaments makers and the financial world that's ripping the planet off. That has to be brought into control. That's why I'm a great believer in global democracy, because otherwise we leave it to what we have at the moment, which is global plutocracy, ruled by the rich, the corporations. And I would think that we'd be much safer in the hands of 5 billion or 6 billion voters deciding next Saturday whether or not there should, 1/10 of the world's armament spending should go to schooling every child on the planet. I know what the answer would be from the global electorate, but that's not the answer we're getting from those who rule the world at the moment. And I look forward to your son being in charge.
Oh, he's already in charge of me.
Well, with his sister, of course.
Yeah. Well, you're a twin. You're a part of a boy-girl twin set. So
yeah,
I've got more questions
goodness.
For you off stage. But tell us, Bob, about your experience since leaving Parliament and the difference between activism in Parliament and outside of it.
Well, in Parliament, of course, except for one day in which I called Prime Minister Howard a blackmailer because he had told the leader of East Timor that if they didn't sign an agreement, which was terribly unfair to Timor-Leste, about the oil and gas deposits in the Timor Sea, Australia would go ahead and just have it all brought to Australia. And I refused to withdraw the comment and I got dismissed from the Senate for 24 hours. Looking back at Hansard, the word blackmail had been used 272 times before with nobody being checked over it. But anyway, I learnt that good behaviour is not rewarded, that what makes news is bad behaviour. And, you know, I also saw how easily it would be to make Parliament work properly. I would love to be President or Speaker of those chambers.
So what would you do?
Just invoke the rules. That's all.
So they're pretty good?
The rules are excellent. They disallow calumny and nastiness and threatening behaviour, etc. And if implemented, but you see, the government appoints the Speaker in an arrangement with the opposition. One's the Speaker and one's the Deputy Speaker and vice versa in the Senate. So it's a bit of a hopeless political fix at the moment. But
be a pretty hard job too. I mean, I think Tony Smith, isn't it, who's in the chair at the moment, is... I think certainly with some more recent predecessors is giving it a go.
Yes, and likewise the now is going to retire President of the Senate. But anyway, you know, I think also if we were to invoke the Journalist Code of Ethics, the Australian Journalist Code of Ethics, there'd be a transformation in our society. It's routinely... destroyed, not least by the Murdoch newspaper scribes who bring opinion into the papers. So we have views papers, not newspapers, and they do represent the big end of town, and they are about putting down anybody who's rebellious. So to go back to your question, Sally, I love being back as a campaigning environmentalist, and here we are in the Tarkine Forest in Tasmania, and we took to the High Court, laws being brought in to have environmentalists who peacefully stand in the way of chainsaws defending some of the last intact wildlife-filled forests on the planet, jailed for up to 4 years. And the High Court threw that out and said, no, under our constitution is an implied right to protest, and that includes peaceful protest. So the government... instrumentalities just a couple of weeks ago have issued us as 10 or 20 people peacefully up in those forests in the Tarkine, northwest Tasmania, the biggest temperate rainforest in Australia tonight, issued us with an eviction prohibition order because our workplace practices weren't safe. In other words, people sitting in the trees aren't safe, but apparently bringing chainsaws in to knock down these 80 metre high hundreds of tonne trees is safe. It isn't. It's the most unsafe industry in Australia. And on it goes. But we can expect very repressive laws against social and environmental peaceful protests. And all states and federal governments are thinking about or implementing those at the moment because they cannot win the argument. The populace wants the forest protected. The populace does want action on climate change. The populace does want our wildlife protected. The populace does want free and fair education and health, and it does want more taxation on the mega-rich. And they can't win that argument Sally, so they have to resort to taking out the people who put forward that argument. And that's what these laws are about. And ScoMo's latest laws to prohibit secondary boycotts. That is, if you're opposing the Adani mine, you can't ring Siemens and say, we don't want you to supply them with signalling arrangements for their railways, will be illegal if that law gets through the parliament in a few months' time. I blocked that law when I was the only Green in the Senate way back in 2000, and John Howard brought in the secondary boycott law. It couldn't apply to social justice or the environment. But here we are now seeing that law turned around, and it's only being turned around because the coal mining and gas exploration and other big companies have been in there saying, here, change this section of this law. And there won't be much public debate. And unless some of the more astute independents, as well as the Greens and Labor in the Senate, block it, it will go through. And, you know, we have Queensland, West Australia, New South Wales, Victoria, all. And I must say, it began with John Keynes. You know, what a good fellow. He's just departed from us. But he did, in 1986, bring in the first laws upping the penalties for peaceful forest protesters in Victoria, and it spreads nationwide from there. And it's because of the lobbying power of those people who are wanting to transmogrify, to exploit the planetary commons to riches in their own time. And I can tell you, looking you in the eye, Sally, that I will be there with the defenders of those forests when they come to get us. That we cannot back off to the threats of imprisonment or worse against defending the planet. And we cannot back off on our duty to be able to look our grandchildren in the eye and say, I did step off the footpath for you. I did see your rights being taken away. I did see the planet being ruined by this short-term, unsustainable, plainly unsustainable, exploitative age. And I am only sorry to you in one regard. I didn't do much, much more, much, much harder. And I'm writing a little book at the moment called Defiance. Might be the last one. And it's simply about peaceful defiance of what's going on. And it's very hard to put together, you know. It's very hard to know where to draw that line. But it is the planet. And people, our kith and kin, just like us, 100 years from now, unable to come back to now. So it's up to us to be out there and to take it on and to put up with whatever epithets get hurled along the way. Because once your heart's locked into this beautiful planet and to the wonder of people, the creativity of humanity, you know, the great symphonies, the great artworks, the great scientific breakthroughs, the great humanitarian works of people, why would we want that to go? And why aren't we holding it in check? I've just written the foreword for a book for an American, crusading American, a firebrand American environmentalist, Rhys Halter, and he says at the end, after 7 million years, humanity has never faced a crisis like this. It is great to be alive. And I'll just put underneath that, so all of us. We've got the opportunity.
You talk about so much of this is the long game, long not compared to that length of time, but you know, when we all look towards next summer in Australia, what should people be doing?
Planning holidays and planning to have good companions and to go to the beach, preferably in a fire-burnt area where they're struggling to make ends meet now. But at the same time, to be thinking, really, should I vote for more coal mines at the next state or federal election? Really, should I be voting for the logging of what's left of the mountain ash forests of Victoria, which in 1887, the tree measured by the surveyor of the day at 134 metres is still the highest authenticated greatest tree ever on the face of the planet. And what's left of those, 1% of their natural range untampered with, and the extraordinary need for a great forest national park, holiday in Toolangi. Go up and sit there with the knitting nanas and take a thermos and join them. It's a good feeling. Go to the Tarkine Forest. The book may not be up there, but our foundation's got a, Tarkine Trails, which tells you everything about how you can get there. And look, Sally, it's so important. Young people say to me all the time, Bob, why aren't you depressed? Because to be intelligent is to inevitably have a depressed reaction to what's happening on the planet. But I say at the end of that, be active and look after yourself. Have fun. Even if you have to and it's really got you down, go and have a bit of shopping.
I wasn't expecting that.
I'll probably get into trouble, won't I?
That's great.
I really do mean it. We have to have look after ourselves and our loved ones.
Or plant some flowers.
Absolutely. Plant the flowers. He's got it right.
It's been he could write the book on defiance with you, Bob. It's been such a pleasure this evening. I'm just sitting here thinking, you know, optimism is more infectious than probably any virus, right? We'll be okay. It's a pleasure to see you here, to have you as a guest on the Fifth Estate for the first time. It's just been worth the wait, and it felt really like the very right moment. We were so glad you were able to be with us, and thank you all for being such a wonderful audience. We hope to be back in 2 weeks. I really hope so. We'll see what happens, but I hope everybody stays well and safe.
And thank you, Sally.
A pleasure. My pleasure. Thank you, Bob Brown.
Bob Brown and Sally Warhaft in conversation at the Wheeler Centre for the Fifth Estate. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it or leave a review on your favourite podcast platform. And if you're looking for more good conversations while you're stuck at home for the next few weeks, there are more than 100 episodes of The Fifth Estate at wheelercentre.com, as well as an enormous library of free videos, great writing, and lots more. We have just cancelled our next public recording of The Fifth Estate, but we hope to bring you a recorded version instead. Keep an eye on our feed or on the Wheeler Centre's website for updates. But in the meantime, take care.